with the help of scholarships and financial aid, he attended Harvard, the first member of his family to go to college. His perseverance revealed itself in other ways. Because he was then dating a Wellesley student from Kansas City, he took a summer job at Hallmark to be near her. The relationship, however, did not last. After college came Harvard Law School, and after graduating in 1978, he joined the law firm of Donovan, Leisure, Newton, and Irvine. For several years, he practically lived on an airplane flying between New York and Los Angeles. On the rare weekends he found time to relax, he would drive out to Las Vegas with a colleague to play blackjack. They once left their boss a memo: "If we don't show up Monday, it's because we've hit the jackpot." By now, Blankfein had started on the track toward becoming a partner at the firm. But in 1981, he had what he termed a pre-life crisis. He decided that he wasn't meant to be a corporate tax lawyer and applied for jobs at Goldman, Morgan Stanley, and Dean Witter. He was rejected by all three firms, but a few months later got his foot in the door at Goldman. A headhunter sought him out for a job at J. Aaron & Company, a little-known commodities trading firm that was looking for law school graduates who could solve complex problems and then explain to clients precisely what they had done. When he told his fiancée, Laura, who was also a corporate lawyer with the New York firm of Phillips, Neiser, Benjamin, Krim, and Ballin, that he was taking a job as a salesman of gold coins and bars, she cried. Several months later, Blankfein became a Goldman employee when the firm acquired J. Aaron in late October 1981. After the oil shocks and inflation spikes of the 1970s, Goldman was determined to expand into commodities trading. J. Aaron gave the firm a powerful gold and metals trading business and an international presence with a significant London operation. But while Goldman was disciplined and subdued, J. Aaron was wild and loud. When Goldman ultimately moved the trading operations of J. Aaron into 85 Broad Street, its immaculately groomed executives were stunned to see traders with their ties wrenched loose and their sleeves rolled up, who shouted out prices and insults alike. When angered, they pounded their desks with their fists and threw their phones. This was not the Goldman way. And while Goldman prided itself on its culture and its calculated hierarchy, J. Aaron had no use for formalities. After joining, when Blankfein asked what his own title was, he was told, "You can call yourself Contessa if you want." Goldman's Mark Winkelman was given the task of taming this unruly crowd. The Dutch Winkelman was one of Goldman's first foreign partners, known for his analytical brilliance. He was one of the first executives on Wall Street to recognize the importance of technology for trading, as computers became smaller and more powerful. Winkelman first noticed Blankfein when he saw the short salesman wrestle the phone away from a trader who was trying to yell at a client who had cost him money. He shielded his protege from a wave of job cuts at J. Aaron that came the following year, the first widespread layoffs at Goldman. Blankfein was fortunate in other respects as well. Goldman had decided to make a major push into trading bonds, commodities, and currencies, and to take on larger risks. The firm had been a pioneer in commercial paper and a leader in municipal finance, but remained and also ran in fixed income, compared with Salomon Brothers and others. Winkelman and John Corzine overhauled that part of the business and recruited talent from Salomon. Impressed by Blankfein's well-honed diplomacy and his obvious intelligence, Winkelman placed him in charge of six salesmen in currency trading and later the entire unit. Robert Rubin, who then ran fixed income with Stephen Friedman, was opposed to the move. "We've never seen it work to put salespeople in charge of trading in other areas of the firm," Rubin told Winkelman. "Are you pretty sure of your analysis?" "Really appreciate your experience, Bob, but I think he'll do all right," Winkelman responded. "Lloyd's driven, and he is a very smart guy with a very inquiring mind, so I have some confidence." The young lawyer soon demonstrated his trading prowess by structuring a trade that allowed a Muslim client to obey the Quran's prescriptions against interest payments. At the time, the complex $100 million deal, which involved hedging Standard & Poor's 500 contracts, was the biggest Goldman had ever done. Blankfein was also a serious reader, taking stacks of history books with him when he went on vacation. Never flashy or self-promoting, he was an almost ideal embodiment of the culture at Goldman, where no one ever said, "I did this trade," but rather, "We did this trade." Winkleman was crushed when he was passed over for Corzine and Hank Paulson in the top jobs at Goldman in 1994. Blankfein, who was made partner in 1988, was one of the four executives named to take over Winkleman's responsibilities. Winkleman left the firm. By 1998, as co-head of fixed income, currency, and commodities, Blankfein was running one of the most profitable businesses at the firm. But he was not seen as an obvious candidate for the top job. Eventually, Paulson was won over by Blankfein's raw intellect and made him his co-president, prompting John Thain to leave the firm. For his part, Blankfein shaved his beard, lost 50 pounds, and quit smoking. When Paulson was nominated as Treasury Secretary in May 2006, he announced that he had selected Blankfein as his replacement. For as long as Blankfein could remember, Goldman had been thinking that it might need a partner. In 1999, during Paulson's stewardship, he had held secret merger talks with J.P. Morgan, soon after the firm had gone public. Those discussions ended abruptly when Paulson came home to his apartment one day and had an epiphany. Legally, we would be buying Morgan, but J.P. Morgan was so much bigger than Goldman Sachs that in reality, they would be taking us over, and they would bury us, he later recalled. I also knew that somehow we'd figure out how to do everything they could do. During the Clinton administration's first term, Congress was working on the legislation that would repeal the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, tearing down the walls dividing banks, brokers, and other financial businesses. At the time, lobbyists for Goldman actually persuaded the committee writing the bill, which became the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act of 1999, to include a minor amendment they had sought in the event that they ever wanted to become a bank holding company. That provision allowed any bank that owned a physical power plant to continue to own it as a bank holding company. Of course, Goldman was the only bank that owned a power business. Blankfein reflected on this history as O'Neill finished his presentation with a series of questions. Do we need to become a commercial bank? What does it mean if we become a commercial bank? How can we use deposits? How do we build a deposit base? Blankfein was quick to speak up afterward to encourage discussion. Deposits provide funding only for certain activities, he reminded the group. Gary Cohn tried to explain the situation in greater detail, saying that they wouldn't be allowed to make bets with all of the deposits and advising them that they would have to go out and buy some mortgages or go into the credit card business or originate mortgages. These were businesses in which Goldman had no experience, and entering them would mean changing the company in a fundamental way. Sitting beneath 20-foot-high chandeliers in the conference room, the directors and executives batted around a number of different ideas, developing an internet bank, growing the firm's private wealth management business. After an hour of debating alternatives, O'Neill shifted the discussion in another direction by proposing a different alternative, by an insurance company. Insurance might have seemed at first glance an even more radical departure for Goldman than becoming a commercial bank. But Blankfein made the case that the two industries were more similar than dissimilar. Insurers use premiums from ordinary customers, just as bankers use deposits from customers, to make investments. It was no accident that Warren Buffett was a big player in the industry. He used the float of premiums from his insurance companies to finance his other businesses. Similarly, what was known in insurance parlance as actuarial risk was not unlike Goldman's own risk management principles. Goldman could not buy just any insurer, however. It would have to be a company large enough to put more than a dent in Goldman's already hefty balance sheet. The top name on O'Neill's list was AIG, American International Group, which by some measures was the biggest insurance company in the world. The stock price of AIG had recently been decimated, so it might even be economical. Doing a deal with AIG had not, in fact, been a new idea. A possible merger had been talked about in hushed whispers at 85 Broad Street for years. Previous leaders of Goldman, John Whitehead and John Weinberg, both of whom were friends of Hank Greenberg, had suggested to him that the companies should perhaps do a deal someday. Everyone in the group had a view about AIG. Rajat K. Gupta, senior partner emeritus of McKinsey & Company, was intrigued, as was John H. Bryan, the former CEO of Sara Lee and one of Paulson's closest friends. Bill George, the former head of Medtronic, the medical technology giant, appeared a bit more hesitant, and Gary Cohn said frankly that the idea made him nervous. They all looked to one particular board member for direction, Edward Liddy. As the chief executive of Allstate, the major auto and home insurer, Liddy was the one person in the room with actual experience in the insurance business. Some 5 years earlier, Liddy had even tried to sell his firm to AIG, and Greenberg had dismissively rejected his pitch. "I think you ought to keep it," Greenberg told him. Whenever the subject of insurance had come up at previous board meetings, Liddy had been unenthusiastic. "It's a totally different game," he had warned. His view on the matter hadn't changed, no matter how much of a bargain AIG may have seemed. "It isn't worth getting entangled with AIG," he insisted. The morning session ended without any decisions being made about AIG, but the insurer came up again after lunch for an entirely different reason. AIG traded through Goldman, as well as other Wall Street firms, and like many other companies, would put up securities as collateral. There was just one problem. AIG was claiming that its securities were worth a good deal more than Goldman thought they were. Although Goldman's auditor was looking into the matter, there was another snag. The auditor, PricewaterhouseCoopers, also worked for AIG. In a video conference presentation from New York, the PwC executive updated the board on its dispute with AIG over how it was valuing, or in Wall Street parlance, marking to market its portfolio. Goldman executives considered AIG was marking to make-believe, as Blankfein told the board. Strangely, however, no one in the room in Moscow made the critical connection. No one raised the collateral dispute as evidence of a potential fatal flaw in Goldman's consideration to merge with AIG, that the company itself was in serious trouble and had resorted to overvaluing its securities as a stopgap. Instead, the afternoon session proceeded with upbraiding PricewaterhouseCoopers. "How does it work inside PwC if you as a firm represent two institutions where you're looking at exactly the same collateral and there's a clear dispute in terms of valuation?" John Winkelried, Goldman's co-president, pointedly asked. It was the second time PwC had been criticized during a Goldman board meeting. Goldman's board had first learned of the collateral dispute with AIG in November 2007. At the time, the sum involved was more than $1.5 billion. Nervously, Goldman started buying up protection in the form of credit default swaps, insurance, against the possibility that AIG would fail. Given that no one at the time seriously thought that would ever happen, the insurance was relatively cheap. For $150 million, Goldman could insure some $2.5 billion worth of debt. The Goldman board ended its day in St. Petersburg in a more leisurely manner. With the northern sky still light well after 10 p.m., the 13 directors and their spouses rode gondolas along the city's storied canals. On Sunday, the board flew down to Moscow for the second part of the meeting, gathering at the Ritz-Carlton on the edge of Red Square. Mikhail Gorbachev was the speaker at their dinner that evening. Power in Russia was still very much in the hands of Vladimir Putin, even though Dmitry Medvedev had recently been elected to succeed him. Many foreign investors feared that Russia's commitment to open and free markets was quickly fading, particularly in light of the power grabs in the energy industry. Gorbachev, who had initiated the changes that led to the end of communist rule, struck several Goldman directors as oddly deferential to the Kremlin. "Russia is now realizing its potential as a democratic state, opening itself up to new ideas and outside investment." Some directors joked that if the last hotel wasn't bugged, this one certainly must be. In a strange coincidence, late that afternoon, another key figure in American finance arrived in Moscow. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson had come there on a stop on a 5-day European tour that would later take him to Berlin, Frankfurt, and then London. He had been on the road a great deal that month, visiting the Persian Gulf states, attending the Group of Eight meeting of finance ministers in Osaka, Japan, and now passing through Europe and Russia. The highlight of his trip, he hoped, would be London, where he had been preparing to give what he believed would be an important speech at Chatham House, an international affairs research group, in St. James Square. Crafted with the help of his lieutenant, David Nason, the talk would herald a proposed overhaul of financial regulation. As he continued to be concerned about firms like Lehman, he knew he needed to call for new tools to deal with troubled institutions. He wanted to get ahead of the problems while things still seemed stable. On the flight over, he had reviewed the speech, making last-minute changes, knowing that he'd have little time to do so once he arrived in Moscow. To address the perception that some institutions are too big to fail, we must improve the tools at our disposal for facilitating the orderly failure of a large, complex financial institution, he planned to say. As former Federal Reserve Chairman Greenspan often noted, the real issue is not that an institution is too big or too interconnected to fail, but that it is too big or interconnected to liquidate quickly. Today, our tools are limited. It was a risky gambit to announce to the world that the government lacked the authority to prevent a major failure. Such a sentiment could undermine confidence in the markets even further. But he also knew that it needed to be said, and even more so, that the situation needed to be fixed. On Saturday night, Paulson had dinner with Finance Minister Alexei Kudrin in the Oval Dining Room at Spasso House, the residence of the American ambassador in Moscow. On Sunday, he had scheduled a busy day, including half a dozen meetings, a radio interview, and private sessions with Medvedev and Putin. Paulson had earlier told reporters that he wanted to discuss with the Russians best practices for huge state-owned investment funds known as sovereign wealth funds, which were primarily associated with wealthy Middle East nations. But before he ended his evening on Saturday, he had one last meeting after dinner. Just days earlier, when Paulson learned that Goldman's board would be in Moscow at the same time as him, he had Jim Wilkinson organize a meeting with them. Nothing formal, purely social, for old time's sake. For fuck's sake, Wilkinson thought. He and Treasury had had enough trouble trying to fend off all the Goldman Sachs conspiracy theories constantly being bandied about in Washington and on Wall Street. A private meeting with its board? In Moscow? For the nearly 2 years that Paulson had been Treasury Secretary, he had not met privately with the board of any company, except for briefly dropping by a cocktail party that Larry Fink's BlackRock was holding for its directors at the Emirates Palace Hotel in Abu Dhabi in June. Anxious about the prospect of such a meeting, Wilkinson called to get approval from Treasury's general counsel. Bob Hoyt, who wasn't enamored of the optics of such a meeting, said that as long as it remained a social event, it wouldn't run afoul of the ethics guidelines. Still, Wilkinson had told Rogers, "Let's keep this quiet," as the two coordinated the details. They agreed that Goldman's directors would join him in his hotel suite following their dinner with Gorbachev. Paulson would not record the social event on his official calendar. That evening, the Goldman party boarded a bus to take them the dozen or so blocks to the Moscow Marriott Grand Hotel on Tsarskaya Street. Some felt as if they were taking part in a spy thriller, what with the security detail and the grandeur of downtown Moscow. The directors walked through the bright lobby with its large fountain and were escorted upstairs to the Treasury Secretary's rooms. "Come on in," a buoyant Paulson said as he greeted everyone, shaking hands and giving bear hugs to some. For the next hour, Paulson regaled his old friends with stories about his time in Treasury and his prognostications about the economy. They questioned him about the possibility of another bank blowing up, like Lehman, and he talked about the need for the government to have the power to wind down troubled firms, offering a preview of his upcoming speech. "Nonetheless," he told them, "my own view is that we have tough times ahead of us, but based upon history, I think we may come out of this by year's end." It was that comment that Blankfein recalled the following day to a director over breakfast. "I don't know why he'd say that," Blankfein said quizzically. "It can only get worse." Chapter 10. One afternoon in late June, Dick Fuld stepped into the bustling lobby of the Hilton Hotel on 6th Avenue and 53rd Street. He was late, which made him even more anxious about the meeting he was about to attend. Within days of Bart McDade's being named Lehman's new president, he had made a startling demand of Fuld. He wanted to rehire Michael Gelband and Alex Kirk, the two senior traders Joe Gregory had fired. The men, whom Gregory used to call the naysayers, were among the most vocal opponents of the firm's escalation of risk over the years. "We need these guys," McDade had told Fuld regarding his decision. "They already know the positions," referring to Lehman's portfolio of toxic assets, which they still hoped to sell. And McDade said that both of them had the support of the troops on the trading floor, which was critical in restoring confidence. McDade hadn't given Fuld much choice in the matter, and, given that Fuld had just handed McDade authority over the day-to-day operations of the firm, he felt he had to go along with his wishes for the good of the firm, as embarrassing as it might be to have his own judgment challenged so publicly. Before he did, however, he told McDade, "Look, you're not hiring either guy back until I talk to them." Now Fuld was on his way to a face-to-face with Gelband, whom he hadn't seen in over a year. The tension was palpable as they both took seats in a dark meeting room. "We need to clear the air," Fuld said, acknowledging that there was still some unfinished business to resolve. "Let's understand, you're coming back. I want to fucking hear from you." Gelband, a broad six-footer with a closely shaved head, didn't appreciate Fold's aggressive tone and had no patience for bullying or bluffing. As far as he was concerned, he was doing Fold a favor by returning amid the turmoil. Indeed, ironically enough, before agreeing to come back to Lehman, he had been recruited to take Joe Cassano's job at AIG. "How's that, Dick?" he asked. "The last time we talked, okay, not the last time, but when you were at the firm, and you and I talked about your bonus, I got the sense that you were unhappy with it, and that pissed me off, because you made a shitload of money in 06, Fuld said, pouring himself a glass of water. Gelband thought this was an unusual way to begin a meeting that he believed had been intended as something of a reconciliation. They had had a frank discussion about his bonus the year that he left, when he had earned more than $25 million, but he didn't remember having complained about it too vociferously. "That's interesting, because I didn't have a problem with my bonus," Gelband said. "In fact, I was completely fine with it." "Well, that's not what Joe told me," Fuld said. For a moment, they set aside their differences and talked about the firm, reminiscing about the better times, and reviewing Lehman's prospects. It was clear the company would have to unwind its positions as quickly as possible and try to get the best possible price for them. Gelband said he would have to conduct an inventory of the assets to get a sense of their value. Fuld also told him that it was his intention to raise additional capital. "There is just one thing you need to understand," Gelband said as the meeting was coming to a close. "The one reason I am coming back is because of Bart." As Fuld knew, Gelband had been a longtime friend of McDade's. They had been classmates at the University of Michigan Business School, and it was McDade who had helped Gelband get his initial job interview at Lehman. "Well, yes, Bart is going to be running the day-to-day business," Fuld said, trying to sound nonchalant. "But I hope it has something to do with me as well." Gelband looked at him quizzically and replied, "No, no, this has to do with Bart." On the 4th of July weekend, Hank and Wendy Paulson were walking along the beach on Little St. Simon's Island when they spotted a loggerhead sea turtle laying its eggs in the sand. For nature lovers like the Paulsons, it was an extraordinary moment, and they stopped to marvel at the sight. Paulson had flown down to the tiny island, just off of Georgia's coast and some 60 miles south of Savannah, to relax with his wife after what had seemed like a whirlwind of travel and work. The island, a sanctuary for unusual birds and reptiles, is where he liked to go to clear his head. He liked it so much that the Paulsons bought up 3/4 of the 10,000-acre property starting in 2003 for $32.65 million. The European trip had been a success. His speech in London about the need to build a safety net for investment banks in order to prevent a failure from reverberating throughout the system had attracted a great deal of notice. And at the reception afterward at No. 10 Downing Street, Gordon Brown, The Prime Minister congratulated him for thinking ahead and getting out in front of the problem. Still, as Paulson walked the shore, he was finding it difficult to unwind. He continued to have deep misgivings about the economy in the near term, and had stated as much on his trip. The U.S. economy is facing a trio of headwinds: high energy prices, capital markets turmoil, and a continuing housing correction. Apart from his general systemic concerns, though, Paulson's immediate worry was Lehman Brothers. He had spoken to Fold from his cabin on the island earlier in the day, and it was becoming clearer to him that the firm was unlikely to find a buyer. Most of the large sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East and Asia had been stung by investments they had made in other U.S. banks back in December, and wouldn't be likely to invest in Lehman, at least not in the present. Paulson feared that Fold could soon run out of options. However much these concerns preoccupied Paulson, he kept them to himself. He never discussed business with Wendy. The topic of Lehman was off-limits within the family for another reason. Hank's younger brother, Richard Paulson, worked as a fixed-income salesman in Lehman's Chicago office. They purposely avoided discussing the matter whenever they spoke, but he knew that if Lehman were to fail, his brother could lose his job. Paulson was also grappling with another potential setback. He might be losing his deputy, Bob Steele, who was on the short list to run Wachovia, the giant Charlotte-based bank that had just ousted its CEO after reporting a $708 million loss tied to the housing market. Paulson and Steele had talked about the prospect in June, when things were calmer, and Paulson had even encouraged him to pursue the position. But now it looked as if it was actually going to happen, leaving Paulson with a big hole to fill. The timing could not have been worse. Steele's jurisdiction included Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the government-sponsored enterprises, GSE, that had been the engine of the real estate boom and were now becoming undone. By the time Paulson had flown back home on a private chartered jet to Dulles Airport on Monday afternoon, his worst fears were being realized. The financial markets were in a meltdown, but for reasons Paulson could not quite put his finger on. Freddie tumbled as much as 30% on Monday, before recovering to end down 17.9%. Fannie shares slid 16.2%, to their lowest level since 1992. Other financial stocks were suffering as well. Lehman shares closed down more than 8%. As he tried to absorb all that, Steele announced that he had gotten the job, and it would be announced publicly on Tuesday. At home that night in his living room, Paulson paged through the piles of faxes that had been sent to him by his assistant at Treasury. One of them was the report that had set off the panic. Bruce Harting, an analyst at Lehman Brothers, wrote that revised accounting rules might require Fannie and Freddie to raise an additional $75 billion in combined new capital. The report revived all the fears about the two mortgage giants, reminding investors of how thin a cushion they had if the housing slump deepened. If confidence was eroding in the government-sponsored enterprises, businesses that the market believed had the implicit backing of taxpayers, the entire U.S. economy could be threatened. Paulson could see that unease about Fannie and Freddie was growing. On CNBC's Squawk Box that Tuesday morning, James B. Lockhart III, chairman of the Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight, which regulated Fannie and Freddie, tried to calm the markets. "Both of these companies are adequately capitalized," he said. "Both of these companies are managing through these issues and have tested management teams." Paulson had a one-word judgment of that assessment that he later shared with his staff: bullshit. For months, Paulson and his team had been discussing ways to unwind Fannie and Freddie should a real crisis hit. He considered their situation far more important to the long-term health of the economy than Lehman's or the other investment banks. But he knew it was all too easy to get bogged down in the political fighting over the controversial companies that had made home ownership a near right during the boom. With its critics insisting that Fannie and Freddie were neck-deep in the subprime mess, Paulson had, a year earlier, called the debate over Fannie and Freddie "the closest thing I've seen to a holy war." While shares of the companies recovered on Tuesday from the Monday sell-off, both were still trading below $20, and there were other indications of nervousness. Credit default swaps on the debt sold by Fannie and Freddie, essentially insurance, were trading at levels reserved for companies with credit ratings 5 levels below their own AAA ratings, the highest a company could have. Those ratings were, in fact, more a reflection of the government's implicit backing than the company's own fundamentals. As Paulson and his staff prepared for a congressional hearing 2 days hence to discuss the fates of Fannie and Freddie, Steele stuck his head into the conference room next to his office. "Okay, Hank, I'm taking off." Paulson glanced up for a moment. "Okay, Bob, I'll see you later." "No, no," said Steele. "I mean, this is it. I'm leaving." Finally realizing that Steele was bidding his farewells to the staff, Paulson got up to see his deputy off. As they walked down the hall, Paulson joked, "You're getting out just in time." Virtually from the moment that Congress created Fannie Mae, originally the Federal National Mortgage Association, in 1938, it was politically divisive. A product of the housing slump of the Great Depression and Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal, the company was formed to buy loans from banks, savings banks, and other lenders in order to promote home lending by reducing lenders' risk and to increase the amount of capital available for housing. Republicans saw Fannie as a mere sinecure for their political opponents. In 1968, with a federal budget burdened by the costs of both the Vietnam War and the Great Society, Lyndon Johnson began the process of privatizing Fannie. As a sop to its critics, a rival company, the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, or Freddie Mac, was created in 1970. Fannie and Freddie played the political game even more fiercely than their opponents, spending millions of dollars on armies of lobbyists on Capitol Hill. Each company was a revolving door for the powerful in Washington, both Republican and Democrat. Newt Gingrich and Ralph Reed, among others, worked as consultants for Fannie or Freddie. Rahm Emanuel was a board member of Freddie. By the 1990s, Fannie's chief executive could boast, without much exaggeration, that "we are the equivalent of a Federal Reserve System for housing." At their pinnacle, the two mortgage giants, neither of them an originator of loans, owned or guaranteed some 55% of the $11 trillion U.S. mortgage market. Beginning in the 1980s, the two companies also became important conduits for the business of mortgage-backed securities. Wall Street loved the fees it collected from securitizing all kinds of debt, from car loans to credit card receivables, and Fannie's and Freddie's portfolios of mortgages were the biggest honeypot around. But in 1999, under pressure from the Clinton administration, Fannie and Freddie began underwriting subprime mortgages. The move was presented in the press as a way to put homes within the reach of countless Americans. But providing loans to people who wouldn't ordinarily qualify for them was an inherently risky business, as telegraphed by the New York Times the day the program was announced. In moving even tentatively into this new area of lending, Fannie Mae is taking on significantly more risk, which may not pose any difficulties during flush economic times. But the government-subsidized corporation may run into trouble in an economic downturn, prompting a government rescue similar to that of the savings and loan industry in the 1980s. The success of the two companies in both the financial and political arena inevitably fostered a culture of arrogance. "We always won, we took no prisoners, and we faced little organized political opposition," Daniel Mudd, then the president of Fannie Mae, wrote in a 2004 memo to his boss. That overconfidence led both companies eventually to move into derivatives and to employ aggressive accounting measures. They were later found by regulators to have manipulated their earnings, and both were forced to restate years of results. The CEOs of both companies were ousted. Fannie and Freddie were still reeling from the accounting scandals when in March 2008, just days after the rescue of Bear Stearns, the Bush administration lowered the amount of capital the two companies were required to have as a cushion against losses. In exchange, the companies pledged to help bolster the economy by stepping up their purchases of mortgages. But by that Wednesday, July 10, 2008, with investors unloading the stocks in droves, it was all coming undone. That afternoon, William Poole, the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, said unambiguously, Congress ought to recognize that these firms are insolvent, that it is allowing these firms to continue to exist as bastions of privilege financed by the taxpayer. Unfucking believable, Dick Fuld exclaimed to Scott Friedheim as he sank deeper into his office chair. Lehman's stock had opened Thursday morning down 12% to an 8-year low in response to a rumor that Pacific Investment Management Company, the world's biggest bond fund, had stopped trading with the firm. Another piece of speculation was swirling that SAC Capital Advisors, Stephen Cohen's firm, was also no longer trading with Lehman. I know it's not true. You know it's not true, Fuld said to Friedheim. You've got to call these guys and get them to put out a statement. It had been an excruciating week. With the continued market jitters over Fannie and Freddie, the result of Lehman's own analysts' report, no less, investors were also taking it out on the firm. Fuld couldn't understand it. Lehman had taken its lumps in its previous quarter and raised new capital. Its balance sheet, he thought, was in better shape than it had been in a long time, reflecting Lehman's decision to deleverage its investments, that is, reduce the amount of debt it used to make those investments. To Fuld, it was the shorts who kept driving down the stock price, spreading false information about Lehman's health. Fuld had been told by several people that the whisper campaign against the firm was emanating from one place, Goldman Sachs. It made Fuld sick. His son, Richie, worked at Goldman as a telecommunications banker. He decided the time had come to call Lloyd Blankfein personally. "You're not going to like this conversation," Fuld began. He said he had been hearing a lot of noise about Goldman's spreading misinformation. "I don't know that you're not ordering this," he said menacingly, as if trying to intimidate Blankfein into admitting it. Blankfein, offended that Fuld would even attempt to bully him, said he knew nothing about the rumors and ended the call. These conversations became almost daily occurrences. Days later, Fuld heard rumors that Credit Suisse was spreading rumors about Lehman. He jumped on the phone to Paul Colello, CEO of Credit Suisse's investment bank. "I feel like I'm playing whack-a-mole," Fuld told Colello. The constant stream of bad news was not only affecting Lehman's stock, but was hampering Fuld's efforts to raise more capital. Skip McGee's investment banking team had been reaching out to at least a dozen prospects, Royal Bank of Canada, HSBC, and General Electric among them, but was coming up empty. The only suitor with any real interest continued to be the Korea Development Bank's Min Il-sung, and though many executives on the 31st floor still had doubts about him, Fuld had directed the bankers to keep working on the Koreans. Indeed, he was even thinking about taking a trip to Asia himself, to see Min in person to try to seal a deal. Then it struck him. What about his old friend John Mack at Morgan Stanley, the second largest investment bank in the country after Goldman Sachs? The firm had had an ugly second quarter, reporting a 57% decline in earnings from a year earlier, but it still had enough cash and buoyancy in its stock price to be able to make a deal. Fuld and Mack had come up on Wall Street together, with Mack joining Smith Barney's training program in 1968 before moving to Morgan Stanley in 1972, when it had just 350 employees. Like Fuld, Mack had begun his career in bond sales and trading, and again like Fuld, he had quickly made a name for himself. He was an effective salesman and someone who could be both charming and physically intimidating. Mack would stride through the trading floor and, seeing a chance to make big profits, would yell, "There's blood in the water. Let's go kill someone." Coming across a trader reading the Wall Street Journal at 8 a.m., he was known for saying, "I see that again and you're fired." But again, like Fuld, he was also fiercely loyal to his people. Once physically barring entry to the trading floor by upper management when he was still a trader. Fuld called Morgan Stanley in New York and was transferred to Paris, where Mack was visiting with clients in the firm's ornate headquarters, a former hotel on the Rue de Mansur. After some mutual disparagement of the markets, the rumors, and the pressure on Fannie and Freddie, Fuld asked candidly, "Can't we try to do something together?" Mack had suspected the reason for Fuld's call, and while he didn't believe there was much chance that he'd be interested in such a prospect, he was willing to hear Fuld out. There might at least be some assets that he would be interested in. He doubted he would want to buy the entire firm. Mac told him he would be flying back to New York on Friday and suggested they see each other on Saturday. Fuld, clearly anxious to set up the meeting, said, "We'll come over to your offices." "No, no, that makes no sense. What if someone sees you coming into the building?" Mac asked. "We're not going to do that. Come to my house. We'll all meet at my house." A harried Hank Paulson walked into room 2128 of the Rayburn House office building and took his seat. Today's House Financial Services Committee hearing was scheduled to discuss financial market regulatory restructuring, but it was really just about Fannie and Freddie. Paulson also wanted to start laying the groundwork for obtaining authority from Congress to wind down these government-sponsored enterprises, if it became necessary, which he didn't anticipate. Paulson had visited Barney Frank, the chairman of the hearing, earlier in the week, and had been encouraged to ask for what you need. Frank had pledged to support him. Now, as Paulson appeared before the committee with Ben Bernanke beside him, he made his case. "We're going to need broader emergency authorities for the resolution or wind-down of complex financial institutions that don't have federal deposit insurance," he explained. "But that's where we need to get. That's what we've got to drive toward." Representative Dennis Moore, a Democrat from Northeast Kansas, asked, "Do you still believe the GSEs pose a systemic risk to the economy?" Paulson replied, "I would say, Congressman, in today's world, I don't think it is helpful to speculate about any financial institution and systemic risk. I'm dealing with the here and now." But by the time the market closed that day, the here and now had grown even worse, with more than $3.5 billion in the combined market value of Fannie and Freddie wiped out. Concerns were mounting about Fannie's and Freddie's debts and the rocky state of the mortgage-backed securities that the agencies had guaranteed. The markets were testing Washington's resolve. How much chaos would the government tolerate before it stepped in? Although Paulson hadn't believed he would require in the immediate future the authorities that he had discussed that morning, the overall economic situation was beginning to become alarming. He called Josh Bolton at the White House to sound him out about pressing Congress for the authority he wanted. Bolton was encouraging. He also wanted Alan Greenspan's advice. And after some confusion about tracking down Greenspan's home phone number, Paulson and half a dozen staff members huddled over the Polycom on his desk to hear the former Fed chairman's faint voice through the speaker. Rattling off reams of housing data, Greenspan described how he considered the crisis in the markets to be a once-in-a-hundred-year event and how the government might have to take some extraordinary measures to stabilize it. The former Fed chairman had long been a critic of Fannie and Freddie, but now realized that they needed to be shored up. He did have one suggestion about the housing crisis, but it was a rhetorical flourish befitting his supply-and-demand mindset. He suggested that there was too much housing supply, and that the only real way to really fix the problem would be for the government to buy up vacant homes and burn them. After the call, Paulson, with a laugh, told his staff, "That's not a bad idea. But we're not going to buy up all the housing supply and destroy it." As Paulson took a seat in the small conference room next to his office to begin breakfast with Ben Bernanke, he was flushed and scarcely able to eat. "This is a real problem," he said. The front page of the New York Times had reported that morning that senior administration officials were considering a plan to have the government take over one or both of the companies and place them in a conservatorship if their problems worsen. Someone had leaked the story about Fannie and Freddie. Paulson, guzzling a can of Diet Coke as his oatmeal grew cold, couldn't fathom why a member of the administration would be so foolish as to disclose the plans they had been considering. Whoever it had been, the leak was bound to undermine confidence even further, and Paulson was furious. It had already been a long morning for Paulson, and it showed in his eyes. He had briefed the president in the Oval Office at 7:10 a.m., had a conference call with Tim Geithner at 7:40 a.m., checked in with Larry Fink of BlackRock to get his thoughts on what to do about Fannie and Freddie at 8 a.m., and even squeezed in time to reach out to Dick Fuld 5 minutes later. Soon after the stock market opened, Treasury staffers Jim Wilkinson and Neil Kashkari barged into the room, interrupting Paulson and Bernanke's breakfast, to tell them that the stocks of both Fannie and Freddie were sinking like a stone, down about 22%, and suggesting that Paulson put out a statement to calm the markets. Just as he had feared, the story in the Times had created a panic. With nobody certain what the implications of the government getting involved with Fannie and Freddie could possibly mean. Investors were recalling Paulson's decision to press for the $2 a share deal for Bear Stearns, and asking themselves, would that be the model? Paulson agreed he needed to tamp down all the anxiety. By 10:30 a.m., Treasury issued a statement under Paulson's name stating, "Today, our primary focus is supporting Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in their current form, as they carry out their important mission." By using the phrase, "in their current form," Paulson was trying to send a signal that he had no plans to nationalize the companies, even though he knew he might ultimately have to seek the power to do so. Still miffed by the leak, Paulson walked over to the White House as President Bush was preparing to go over to the Department of Energy on Independence Avenue for a briefing on oil and the energy markets. "Can I ride over with you, sir?" Paulson asked, and on the short trip there, briefed Bush on the Fannie and Freddie situation. Bush, who had been a critic of the GSEs for years, was supportive of Paulson's plan. As the motorcade arrived at their destination, Paulson suggested that when the president spoke to the press that afternoon, he needed to tread carefully, fearful of spooking the markets even more. "Emphasize how committed we are to the stability of these organizations," Paulson told him. Although Freddie's stock price would plunge as much as 51% that day, falling to as low as $3.89, and Fannie shares sank by as much as 49%, they managed to pare back their losses, with Freddie ending the session down only 3.1% and Fannie down 22%. Paulson, meanwhile, began calling congressional leaders to determine what it would take to get Treasury the authority to put capital into Fannie or Freddie or to backstop their debt. Just as the market closed, Paulson had a call with Sheila Bair, the chairwoman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, who shared further dismaying news of the intense pressures in the mortgage market. The FDIC was about to seize IndyMac Bancorp, a mortgage lender, marking the fifth FDIC-insured bank failure that year and the biggest since the savings and loan debacle. Recognizing that Fannie and Freddie could soon spin out of control, Paulson summoned his brain trust to his office at 4:15 p.m. and told them to get ready to work throughout the weekend on a way to stabilize the GSEs. His plan was simple. He wanted to ask for the authority to put money into Fannie and Freddie in the hopes that he'd never actually have to use it. "I want," he instructed, "to announce a plan before the Asian markets open Sunday night." On Saturday morning, Fuld pulled up to John Mack's Tudor mansion in Rye, New York. Despite the beautiful weather, he was tense about the upcoming meeting. "God help me," he thought, "if this leaks." He could already imagine the headlines. "Dick, good morning," Mack said amiably as he greeted Fuld at the front door. Mack's wife, Christy, stepped out to say hello as well. The Morgan Stanley management team had arrived and were socializing in Mack's dining room. There was Waleed Chama and James Gorman, the firm's co-presidents, Paul Taubman, the firm's head of investment banking, and Mitch Petrick, head of corporate credit and principal investments. They had probably been strategizing for hours, Fuld thought. McDade showed up next, dressed in a golf shirt and khakis. McGee was running late. On a table in the den, Christy had put out plates of wraps that she had ordered from the local deli and said, "Everything is all set for you guys." As the group took their seats on sofas around a coffee table, an awkward silence followed. No one knew exactly how to begin. Fuld looked at Mac as if to say, "It's your house, you start." Mac imperturbably glared back, "You asked for the meeting, it's your show." "Well, I'll kick it off," Fuld finally said. "I'm not even sure why we're here, but let's give it a shot." "Maybe there's nothing to do," Max said in frustration as he noticed the discomfort around the room. "No, no, no," Fuld hurriedly interjected. "We should talk." Fuld began by discussing Neuberger Berman, Lehman's asset management business, and one of its crown jewels, as an asset that he would be prepared to sell. He also suggested that Morgan might buy Lehman's headquarters on 7th Avenue, the same building that had been Morgan Stanley's, until Philip Purcell, the firm's former CEO, sold it to Lehman after 9/11. The irony would be rich. "Well," said Mac, not entirely sure what Fuld was proposing, "there are ways we can, you know, there are ways we can work together." He wanted to segue the conversation to Lehman's internal numbers, because even if nothing were going to come of the meeting, it would be helpful to Morgan Stanley to get at least a peek at what was going on inside the firm. The Morgan team began to throw out a barrage of questions. How are things marked? Were you able to sell them inside your marks? How much business has left the firm? McDade ended up doing more of the talking than his boss as he tried to answer them. McGee, whose driver had gotten lost, finally arrived in the middle of the meeting, and Fuld gave him an anxious glare. When Fuld's cell phone started ringing, he excused himself and retreated to the kitchen, leaving the Morgan Stanley side perplexed. Was Lehman working on another deal at the same time? What they didn't know was that the caller was Paulson at his treasury office, checking on Fuld and updating him on his plans to propose a bill about Fannie and Freddie. Fuld was happy to hear that Paulson was seeking to stabilize the GSEs. He knew such a measure could help him as well. When Fuld returned to the living room, he unexpectedly broke into the conversation, saying, "You know, with all these rumors going around about Lehman, I would hope that you won't try to poach any of my people." The Morgan Stanley executives were taken aback. Chama, a Lebanese-born banker who spent most of his time running Morgan's operations from London, retorted, "If you recall, you weren't shy about building your European operation off our talent." The meeting ended with no agreement and what seemed like no incentive to keep talking. "What the fuck was that all about?" Mac asked after the Lehman executives departed. "Was he offering to merge with us?" "This is delusional," Gorman said. Taubman had other worries. Maybe they were being used to help Lehman goose its stock price. "We're playing with fire here," he warned them. "If I were their guys, I'd want to put my own spin on this." Fuld, discouraged but undeterred, drove from Mac's house to Lehman's headquarters in Manhattan, racing down the Henry Hudson Parkway. He had scheduled a call with Tim Geithner for that Saturday afternoon. His outside lawyer, Rajan Cohen, chairman of Sullivan and Cromwell, had recently suggested a new idea to help stabilize the firm, to voluntarily turn itself into a bank holding company. The move, Cohen had explained to Fuld, would give Lehman access to the discount window indefinitely, just like Citigroup or J.P. Morgan have. That, in turn, could take some of the pressure off investors worried about the firm's future. It would also mean that Lehman would become regulated by the Federal Reserve of New York, which would have to sign off on the plan. Cohen, a 64-year-old mild-mannered mandarin from West Virginia, was one of the most influential and yet least well-known people on Wall Street. While soft-spoken and small in physical stature, he had the ear of virtually all the banking CEOs and regulators in the country, having been involved in nearly every major banking transaction of the last three decades. Geithner often relied on him to understand the Federal Reserve's own powers. For the past several months, Cohen had been speaking with Fuld almost daily, trying to help him formulate a plan. He was very familiar with bank failures and wanted to make sure Lehman would not become one of them. Cohen had spent many days in the summer of 1984 in a hot, windowless room in Chicago, trying to work out a rescue of Continental Illinois National Bank and Trust. "We have a new kind of bank," Stuart McKinney, U.S. representative from Connecticut, announced that year. "It is called Too Big to Fail, TBTF, and it is a wonderful bank." The $4.5 billion government rescue plan that emerged was shaped in large part by Cohen. Cohen, who had also advised the board of Bear Stearns in its takeover by J.P. Morgan, had organized the call with Geithner's office. Pacing back and forth in his hotel room in Philadelphia before the wedding of his niece that night, Cohen joined the call between Lehman and the Federal Reserve of New York. "We're giving serious consideration to becoming a bank holding company," Fold started out by saying. We think it would put us in a much better place. He suggested that Lehman could use a small industrial bank it owned in Utah to take deposits to comply with the necessary regulations. Geithner, who was joined on the call by his general counsel, Tom Baxter, was apprehensive that Fold might be moving too hastily. Have you considered all the implications? He asked. Baxter, who had cut short a trip to Martha's Vineyard to participate, walked through some of the requirements, which would transform Lehman's aggressive culture, minimizing risk and making it a more staid institution, in league with traditional banks. Regardless of the technical issues that would have to be faced, Geithner said, I'm a little worried you could be seen as acting in desperation, and the signal that Lehman would send to the markets with such a move. Fold ended his call deflated. He had worked his way through a checklist of every alternative he could think of, and nothing was sticking. He and McDade had even begun working up a plan to consider shrinking Lehman Brothers into a hedge fund with a boutique bank attached, and trying to take the firm private, outside the glare of public investors. But he'd need to raise cash from someone even to do that. Later that evening, Fold called Cohen, finding his lawyer in the waiting room of a hospital, attending to a cousin who had become ill at the wedding. It was time to consider a different kind of deal, he told Cohen. Can you reach out to Bank of America? Selling Lehman had always been anathema to Fold. As long as I am alive, this firm will never be sold, he had said proudly in 2007. And if it is sold after I die, I will reach back from the grave and prevent it. He had, however, longed to make a big acquisition. For a brief moment, he came close to buying Lazard, so close that he had even settled on calling the firm Lehman Lazard, a purchase that might have been his crowning achievement, turning his scrappy bond trading operation into a white shoe firm with a global reputation. Fold had held a meeting in his then office at the World Financial Center on September 10, 2001, with William R. Loomis and Steve Golub of Lazard. They left the meeting with plans to continue their discussions. Then, of course, came 9/11. Bruce Wasserstein, who later took over Lazard, tried to resurrect the discussions, but Fold became so outraged by the price Wasserstein said he wanted, $6 to $7 billion, that their conversation quickly devolved. Clearly we don't see value the same way, Fold derisively told him. To Fold, Wasserstein, who had been branded Bit-Him-Up Bruce, had just lived up to his name. There's just no way I could pay that. Still standing in the emergency room of the hospital, Rodgen Cohen found Greg Curl, Bank of America's top deal banker, on his cell phone in Charlotte, where the bank was based. Curl, a 60-year-old former naval intelligence officer who drives a pickup truck, had always been a bit of an enigma to Wall Street. He had helped orchestrate nearly every deal Bank of America had made over the past decade. But even within the bank, he kept to himself and was generally considered a tough read. Cohen, who had dealt with Curl over the years but had never been able to take an accurate assessment of him, treaded carefully, explaining that he was calling on behalf of Lehman Brothers. "Do you have any interest in doing a deal? Of all the institutions we've been considering, you'd be the best fit," Cohen said, promising that he could get Fold on the phone if Curl was curious enough to have a conversation. Curl, though intrigued to be getting a call on a Saturday night, was noncommittal. He could tell they must be desperate. Let me talk to the boss, he said. I'll call you right back. The boss was Ken Lewis, the silver-haired CEO of Bank of America, a hard-charging banker from Walnut Grove, Mississippi, who was on a mission to beat Wall Street at its own game. When he was a child, two boys once ganged up on him. His mother, catching sight of the scrap, came out of the house and said, "Okay, you can fight him, but you're going to have to do it one at a time." A half hour later, Curl called back to say he'd hear them out. And Cohen set up a three-way call with Fold through the switchboard at Sullivan and Cromwell. After some brief introductions, the men had never met before, Fold began with his pitch. "We can be your investment banking arm," Fold explained, the idea being for Bank of America to take a minority position in Lehman Brothers, and for the two to merge their investment banking groups. He invited Curl to meet with him in person to discuss the proposal further. Curl, sufficiently intrigued, said he would fly up from Charlotte to New York on Sunday. While Full thought it odd that he wasn't negotiating directly with Ken Lewis, there was a compelling reason for Curl to travel alone. Lewis could legitimately deny that he had ever spoken with Fold, should the discussion leak.